Today's episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, a place to grow, connect, and serve. Find out more at canbyfoursquare.com or on Sunday mornings at 9 and 11 a.m.
This episode is also brought to you by Chris Salee, your local health markets insurance agency. Creative solutions for your health, Medicare, and life insurance needs. Personalized advice at 503-678-5768. Welcome to the Canby Now podcast.
Your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
The Clackamas County Board of Commissioners has approved a significant tax break to Columbia Distributing. For its new 530,000 square foot beverage and warehouse distribution facility in Canby. The abatement, which would save the company an estimated $5 million in property taxes over the next 15 years, must also be approved by the Canby City Council before it can be submitted to the State Economic Development Agency, which has the final say. If granted, Columbia would receive a 15-year abatement on property taxes due over the $25 million mark. It's not yet known what the ultimate assessed value of their property will be, but it's being estimated in the range of $50 to $60 million. In return, they would have to pay full taxes on the first $25 million and follow other criteria, such as hiring locally and using local contractors where possible. The company must also give back a quarter of the abated taxes in the form of a community service fee, the disbursement of which must be agreed upon by all the impacted taxing districts. In this case, Columbia's full abated amount is anticipated to total $6.89 million over the next 15 years, but it will return $1.72 million of that in the community service fee for a total savings of around $5 million. If approved, as many as a dozen local taxing districts would be impacted, the biggest losers being Canby Schools, the city, the Canby Urban Renewal Agency, the county itself, and the Canby Fire District. According to the company's chief financial officer, Paul Mead, this tax abatement was an important factor in Columbia's decision to relocate their Portland metro area operations to Canby. However, due to an apparent miscommunication between Columbia and Business Oregon, the company failed to file its application before beginning construction, which is a prerequisite of the program. Initially, it appeared that that would disqualify Columbia, but staff working with the county and the state soon hammered out a compromise that would render ineligible only the work that took place prior to when the state received the company's application on July 2nd. This tweaked version of the strategic investment zone is what commissioners approved unanimously during their business meeting last Thursday as part of the consent agenda. The city was scheduled to discuss the matter March 18th, but that meeting was canceled due to concerns related to the coronavirus outbreak. A decision on the matter is now expected at the council's next regularly scheduled meeting on April 1st. Interim City Administrator Amanda Zyber said it will be a, quote, virtual meeting, and they plan to have it televised. More info to come once all the details are sorted out. The Oregon Business Development Commission, which will have the final say, is expected to see Columbia's application at their regularly scheduled meeting on April 10th. The commission meets quarterly and is not scheduled to reconvene following the April meeting until July 17th. In order to take effect, Columbia's application must be approved by the commission before July 1st. In a video posted to the Gwynn's Coffee House Facebook page Monday afternoon, owner Mallory Gwynn's eyes wet with tears as he gazed over the empty, quiet shop and attempted to explain why his family business is closing its doors. I can't help but think as we put our business plan together that this was a place of community, a place of gathering, and a place of conversation, he said, his voice choked with emotion. And it's not that right now. The coffee house, like most local restaurants and pubs, has spent the past week trying to survive in a new landscape drastically altered by the coronavirus pandemic, where eating establishments can remain open, but offer only takeout and curbside pickup and delivery. For them, it simply wasn't sustainable. As Gwyn admitted, the coffee shop's revenue was already down by half. We simply cannot sustain ourselves that way. So, with heavy hearts and sadness, the Gwyn family made the decision to close the shop until, hopefully, the governor's COVID-related orders are lifted and the economic situation for many has begun to improve. The family did not offer a timeline for the closure or when they hope to be back in business. Gwyn said simply, quote, "We're going to take some time and let this thing pass by, and we'll go from there." Despite the disappointment, he praised the community and thanked them for their support, calling it incredible, just the love and the giving that's going on. "We want to wish all of our customers in this community all the love and appreciation that we have in our hearts," he said. "You've been amazing to us, and we thank you for that." With pots of blooming spring tulips on the table before him, Mallory Gwyn concluded by saying, "We wish all of you well. Be safe, and we'll see you again. We certainly hope so." And friends, just on a personal note, as a longtime patron of Gwyn's Coffee House, I want to say a special thank you to Mallory and Sherry and the family for the work that they have done to invest in the gaming community. You've made this place better, and we are very sad to see you close during this uncertain time, and wish you all the best and a speedy recovery. The former board chair of Aurora-based Columbia Helicopters has donated $2 million to the Providence Health System's response to the COVID-19 outbreak, and she wants others to follow her lead. In a video posted to the Providence Portland Medical Foundation yesterday, Nancy LaMotta says she has been wondering what she can do to assist the state, the nation, and the world's response to the coronavirus pandemic.
I kept thinking, what can I do to help? Could I make masks? Well, I probably couldn't make them the way I'm supposed to. What could I do? And I thought, I can give money. I am very fortunate that I have the ability to give money. I would hope that other people would want to contribute something to it. And if we could meet or exceed this amount from other people, that would be wonderful. I'm happy to be able to do that and hope it can make a difference.
LaMotta, who is also a longtime board member for Providence, said she hoped others would join her in donating to the fund dedicated to the COVID-19 response, which will go toward needed hospital supplies and equipment and fund research of the disease at the Earl A. Childs Research Institute. LaMotta and her late husband, Wes LaMotta, gave $1 million for Providence's cancer research in 2003, but the hospital said she usually donates without publicity. This time, though, she wants to inspire others to give if they are able. Wes LaMotta founded Columbia Helicopters, based at the Aurora State Airport, in 1957, and is now a global leader in heavy lift helicopter operations and manufacture, maintenance, repair, and overhaul services. Its home airfield at the Aurora Airport is named after him. Nancy LaMotta was its board chair until she retired in 2014. Donations can be made at www.providencefoundations.org/COVID-19. The hospital says every gift to combat COVID-19 will, quote, support research and help keep caregivers, patients, and their families safe. Clackamas Community College is working to continue offering essential services and provide online learning to maintain academic continuity for students in the wake of the COVID-19 outbreak. Community college students already face high rates of housing and food insecurity, and the economic and social fallout from the pandemic will make their circumstances all the more precarious. Many CCC students are from low-income homes and do not have access to technology to complete online courses, according to the college. Says John Chang, CCC Foundation Executive Director, "Our students are parents who now don't have childcare, or their school-aged children are home. They work in the service industry and are being laid off from their jobs. They live in rural areas with either no or poor internet service." To offset some of these impacts, the Clackamas County College Foundation has created a COVID-19 relief fund with the goal of raising $200,000 for students and programs impacted by the new coronavirus. The funds will be used to provide internet connection, computers, tuition and fees, and classroom materials to ensure education is accessible to all students. Higher education is the way out and up for our students, and they need some resources to be successful, Chang said. Chang encouraged community members to consider giving to the COVID-19 Relief Fund to ensure students can start, continue, and complete their educational goals. If you would like to donate, visit give.clackamas.edu/COVID-19. Checks may be mailed to the CCC Foundation at 19600 Malala Avenue, Oregon City, Oregon 97045, with COVID relief in the memo line. Canby Police Lieutenant Jose Gonzalez recently completed one of the toughest challenges available to local law enforcement officers, the FBI National Academy. Lieutenant Gonzalez and three other Oregon law enforcement officers graduated a 10-week training session at the FBI National Academy in Quantico, Virginia, earlier this month. There is a highly competitive process local law enforcement officers must go through to be selected for this honor, which includes being nominated by a supervisor, an in-depth interview process, a background check, a determination of physical fitness, and the support of former National Academy graduates with the candidate's organization. According to Ren Cannon, special agent in charge of the FBI in Oregon, quote, "Only a few officers from Oregon have the chance to attend each year. We are proud to sponsor Lieutenant Gonzalez and our other local partners in the National Academy." Lieutenant Gonzalez is originally from Caracas, Venezuela. He earned a bachelor's degree in business administration from Portland State University in 1994. He started his law enforcement career with the Canby Police Department in 1996, but laterally transferred to the Portland Police Bureau in 1998, where he was ultimately promoted to the rank of sergeant in 2005. He had many assignments with Portland Police, including the FBI Safe Streets Task Force. Lieutenant Gonzalez retired from the Portland Police Bureau in 2019 and accepted a position as a lieutenant back with the Canby Police Department. He is currently serving as the lieutenant for the Investigation Unit, Code Enforcement and Evidence Unit, Task Force Partnerships, and Internal Affairs. Canby Police Chief Brett Smith said he appreciated the opportunity for Lieutenant Gonzalez to participate in the National Academy's excellent training, saying, "His nomination and eventual selection to the Academy is an indication of his exceptional leadership qualities and admirable character. We look forward to his return to serve our agency and community with his enhanced knowledge and skills." During the 10 weeks of training, local executive-level law enforcement officers spend most of their time in the classroom. Lieutenant Gonzalez took classes in Leadership Essentials, National Security and Intelligence, Effective Writing, and Contemporary Issues in Law Enforcement. The FBI sponsors 4 sessions of the National Academy each year. Each session includes about 220 local law enforcement officers from throughout the United States and around the world. While in the academy, the officers and deputies live in a dorm-like setting. The FBI does not charge U.S. students for tuition, books, equipment, meals, lodging, or travel to and from their home. You can hear more of Lieutenant Gonzalez's story on episode 59 of the Canby Now podcast entitled, "What's Cookin', Lieutenant?"
All right, folks, it's time for Police Beat for the week of January 28th through February 3rd. And I'm not going to lie, this week is a little dry, you guys. Let's get into it. Contact was made on January 28th with juveniles, and they were smoking marijuana. So, that's it. An officer responded to a resident where a person had passed away. And that is unfortunate. Not going to make a joke about that. On January 29th, contact was made with a juvenile who was under the influence of marijuana. And before you think that this is going to become a repeating thing that I'm going to make fun of throughout the entire segment, that's it. That's the last of the marijuana jokes. So, that's it. Report of fraud after a caller posing as a representative from their cell phone provider investigating an unauthorized purchase asked and was provided with personal information. Don't give out personal information over the phone, people. And if they tell you it's about your car's extended warranty, tell them that you know me and that I'm concerned about my car's extended warranty. I gave him my personal information some time ago, and I haven't heard back from him. So, on January 30th, 8:14 a.m., report of fraud, altered check. Yeah, that's a pretty easy one. At 1:15 p.m., a driver was cited for no license or insurance, and the vehicle was towed. And at 3:32 p.m., report of credit card fraud. So, you thought I was going to do a whole marijuana joke thing. Turns out, it's going to be fraud week. On January 31st at 4:54 p.m., officers responded to a report of a theft at a store. The suspect was subsequently arrested for theft, which that makes sense, and also on an outstanding Multnomah County warrant. At 5:45, report of a stolen bicycle. At 6:20, report of a traffic crash. I'm not going to lie, when I read that, I legitimately thought it was going to say stolen bike and then bicycle crash. And I was going to laugh really hard on this podcast. At 7:51, a suspect was arrested for shoplifting. So lots of shoplifters. On February 1st at 1:01 a.m., suspect was arrested for DUI. At 11:45 a.m., suspect was arrested for shoplifting. And 6:15 p.m., an uninsured vehicle was impounded. Guys, I wasn't lying. This is a dry week. Lots of just standard stuff. No one's ramming into parked vehicles because those are the worst vehicles. No one's, you know, doing offensive littering, the worst kind of littering. And I'm not joking. Not one single bit of meth or heroin came through our town. So that's nice. February 2nd at 11:07, report of mailboxes being damaged overnight. And while that's different, I mean that's okay. And finally on February 3rd, 8:20 a.m., report of a stolen wallet. 4:49, report of a stolen leaf blower. Sorry, that's just, I mean, that sucks. It's still kind of funny, though. I just imagine someone running up and grabbing a leaf blower and running off with it. And the final thing, and I'm sure you guys think I'm going to pull it out with some big joke. Okay, it's at 5:14, report of a hit and run of a damaged parked vehicle. Because we can't deal with these parked vehicles in Canby, right? We got to tell them what's what. We got to tell them who's boss. You don't come into our town. Parked vehicles. You don't come into Canby and pretend like you're in charge. I'm gonna damage you. We're gonna hit and run.
Hey, Tyler, I have to tell you about something.
All right.
This buddy of mine was telling me his internet bill went up right after the holidays. Can you believe it?
I'm sorry, what?
I know. Talk about a Grinch move, am I right?
Why would their bill go up at that time of year, Frankie?
Well, they said it was because of overage fees from going over their data cap. Probably because they had family home for the holidays with way more people than usual using their Wi-Fi. Think about it. You've got kids playing games online, parents streaming TV shows and movies, plus all of the devices everyone has that are connected to the Wi-Fi network. That's a lot of stuff using up data, and they were charged extra for it.
That's super weird. I didn't even know there were like actual things called data caps for internet providers. I use a ton of data every month right here in the studio. And I've never seen an extra fee.
Yeah, that's because we have DirectLink. With them, not only will we never be charged extra fees for using lots of data at any speed, but they also never slow down our internet speed for high usage. It's all part of their commitment to unlimited internet.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Well, hey, I mean, it sounds like your friend should switch over to DirectLink.
Yeah, no kidding.
Hey friends, it's me, James, again. I love coming back to tell you about our wonderful friends who help support us via Patreon. And this week we get to shout out and give a very special Can Be Now thank you to Beverly Hess. Beverly Hess is one of many folks who appreciate the work that we get to do here at the Can Be Now podcast and choose to support us out of her generosity. So Beverly, thank you so much from all of us here at the Can Be Now podcast. We rely on monthly contributions like Beverly's to continue to do this work that we so love. To find out how you can become a supporter of the Can Be Now podcast and, like Beverly, one of the coolest people in the world, you can visit us online at canbenowpod.com/plus. Again, Beverly, and to all our Patreon members, thank you so much for the generosity that allows us to continue on this good work.
Thank you for listening to the Can Be Now podcast.
My guest on the Can Be Conversation today is an old friend in a new place. It's Tony Crawford, longtime teacher for the Can Be School District, calling in via Facebook Messenger from Egypt. Hi, Tony.
Hey, good morning to you, Tyler. And at the same time, it's evening for me. I'm about 10 hours ahead of you today.
Right, right. You just called. And I got to tell you, Tony, I hadn't had my coffee yet. And that's a dangerous game. You got to be careful with that stuff.
I have to tell you, I'm sitting here right now enjoying a cup of tea in my Canby, Oregon mug, and I have to tell you, some things just have not changed. I have spent the afternoon working on homework. I feel much like I did during my career in Canby.
Mm, the more things change, the more they stay the same, huh?
You know, there's much to be said for that. There are so many similarities between our school experience over here and, you know, our school system in the U.S. But, of course, that's part of the point why I'm here. Our school is accredited in the American education system. So very much they want to try to be, you know, following the model of our schools, you know, in the U.S. And I have to be honest, in particular, our schools in Canby, Oregon.
Well, let's start at the top here. So you're in Cairo, is that right?
I am in a section of Cairo. Remember, Cairo is a city of about 30 million people. And depending upon where you draw the boundary lines, you could argue that it's the largest city on earth, kind of in competition with Mexico City.
Okay, so slightly bigger than Canby.
Yes. You know what? When I tell people I'm from a town of about 20,000 people, they remind me that there are probably that many people in the apartment complex that I live in.
No joke. Yeah.
But I will tell you, though, if anyone wants to go to the map, our school is called Modern American School of Egypt, and it's located in New Cairo. And where I live, I'm in a suburb, it's the best way to describe it, of Cairo, called Medinity. And so it's about a 30-minute commute each direction, of course, depending on traffic. But, you know, the place where I live, it's simply beautiful. I'm surrounded by green spaces. This morning, a little humor, I get up to go run each morning, and this morning I thought I was back in Oregon. It was overcast and rainy, and you know, you just kind of don't expect that over here in the Sahara Desert, but it does happen.
Yeah.
You know, so it was kind of a wet, overcast morning, and then turned into a beautiful, sunny afternoon.
Well, I got to tell you, it has not rained once over here since you left. It has been sunny and just balmy. It's been beach weather every day. So, I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah, you're missing it. You're missing it. People are saying it's unprecedented.
My colleagues from Oregon, we had breakfast together this morning. Likewise, they live here in the same complex. And so we walk over to a nearby place humorously called South Park, where there's a collection of restaurants and shops.
Mm-hmm.
And so
and some troublemaking fourth habit. Graders.
Say again.
Some troublemaking fourth graders that have dirty mouths.
Yeah, you know, we try to avoid that part.
Good idea.
But yeah. But you know, we chuckle at the name every time, South Park. But you know, it's been our habit to go out to have breakfast on the weekend. Which, see, coincidentally, we're talking. You and I are having this conversation on Friday. The weekend over here in Egypt is Friday and Saturday.
Mm.
And then the school week is Sunday through Thursday.
Oh, okay.
That's the regular work week. And the reason being is because of the Muslim majority in the country. And so Friday is the equivalent of, you know, like the Christian Sabbath is Sunday. The Muslim Sabbath would be Friday. So,
right.
So everyone goes to mosque and, and it's pretty much just like at home, you know, just a different day of the week.
Hmm.
But, when we gathered this morning, coming back around to that part of the story, we, were commenting how we brought the rain with us because, there's been more rain here than we would have ever anticipated. And the humor is if it rains too much, it's like how we react to the snowfall in the Willamette Valley. It just shuts everything down.
Hmm.
So if there's too much rain, they close school. They shut down roads because the people here are just not comfortable driving on the wet roads.
Yeah, that's funny. So, wow.
Yeah, it kind of is.
So you have been over there. When did you leave? Was it October or November?
I arrived here in mid-August.
Oh,
and
way
so
off.
That was just in time for the school in-service. And so one of the big things was, introducing myself to the staff and getting familiar with, in particular, the staff that I work with.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of curriculum and instruction, and then just getting to know all the teachers and all the support staff at the school. It's a large facility. We have a faculty of over 200,
hmm.
And add in the support staff, and we're somewhere, maybe in the range of 500 employees at,
mm-hmm.
at the school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what, give us an overview of the work that you've been asked to do over there. It's a one-year mission, right?
It is. And, and there's so much to do, but, the title they gave me is I am the academic dean of the school.
Mm-hmm.
And, one of the things that caught me off guard was, I just thought I would be focusing on curriculum and mm-hmm. these sort of things, which mm-hmm. is fine. But my goodness, my job description was expanded to cover personnel matters. And when I looked at a flow chart of our administrative structure, it was like, gulp. I'm the second ranking administrator of the entire school.
Wow.
So, just wanted to make sure that I live up to the expectations that they would have of me. So what I have in particular is I have a staff called heads of department, and each one represents a different discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And so we meet weekly and we're constantly monitoring the needs of teachers. I told them that, it's our role that we are not anyone's boss.
Mm-hmm.
We are here to provide support. And so that's our mission, is to provide support to the teachers so that our students can receive the quality education, you know, that they deserve. But one of the first things, though, as I started, was people wanted to know, so Mr. Tony, which, by the way, there's a cultural thing. They do not use last names here. It's your title and first name. So I'm known
that's
by
just like
you know,
the South.
Even the student. Yeah, you know, and that's the way students, you know, speak to their teachers, you know, title and first name. So I had a student just the other day, a little first grade girl. She comes up to me. She's all excited. She says, Mr. Tony, can I tell you something? Mm-hmm. I said, what would you like to tell me? And she says, I want you to know I love my teacher.
Aww.
And I thought, yeah. And then she gave me a hug. Aww. So like, okay, those kind of moments are pretty cool.
Yeah.
But, you know, so as I'm sharing with them, they say, so Mr. Tony, what is your vision? And I said, well, yeah. You know, let's start with this point. You know, I said, we're talking about teachers. I said, we have to remind ourselves that to identify a high quality teacher, we have to see it like a three-legged stool. And the first leg would be, you know, knowledge. If you're going to teach math, you should know something about math. Then the second leg would be teaching skills. The skill set. Do you have the skills to be a teacher? You know, can you plan lessons? Can you deliver effective instruction? Can you assess students regarding what they've learned?
Can you hold a piece of chalk? Can you point at a blackboard? You know, essential things like that.
Yeah, you know, all those basics and then some. But I told them, I said, there's a third leg to the stool that I'm going to tell you right now is more important. And the other two. And that's the teacher's disposition. Do you have the ability to build a positive relationship with the students in your classroom? Because, and I'm making a point with them, I said, if the answer to that question, unfortunately, is no, then the other two things simply just don't matter. You know, you can have all the knowledge and all the skills, but if you can't build a relationship with your students, then the rest is just insignificant. So what we've focused on is what do we need to do to build these relationships so that our students are responsive, and you know, they will, you know, rise to meet what's asked of them. And so this has been a big focus this year. In fact, I was just going through some mid-year data. That's part of the homework I've been doing today. I conducted a survey. We just finished our first semester. We're on a quarter schedule over here. So quarter two just finished, which likewise is the end of the first semester. And this next week, we begin our second semester. I'm reviewing some survey data regarding, you know, where we are in terms of delivery of the service that's expected of my academic team. So it's been good. It's pretty favorable. Looks like we've, you know, got strong responses from our teachers. But as always, there's some things we can work on to improve our efforts for the next semester.
Yeah. Tony, earlier, earlier you mentioned that, you know, how particularly interested these schools are in emulating some of the things that we're doing here in the United States. And you mentioned even specifically in Canby. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a little bit. I feel like we just hear all the time, especially here in Oregon, how bad our schools are, you know, and how we don't measure up to this or that. What are we doing right here that even other countries are wanting to say, hey, we need a little bit of that?
So here's the thing that just really emerged right away, and I have to put this in context. What I've been asked to do is engage in multiple professional development sessions where I'm putting on workshops for our faculty, and always in these workshops, my reference is to our common practice in the Canby school system, and so for example, one of the things here that is just extremely desirable with the American system in general, and frankly, what we do well in Canby, is moving our students through Bloom's taxonomy. Mm-hmm. And for listeners who are not familiar with Bloom's taxonomy, this is a teacher's basic guide how to move students from the lower levels of learning and thinking, just memorizing content knowledge. That would be the most basic level in Bloom's taxonomy. And then elevating students to higher thinking skills, such as analysis and synthesis, and to evaluate what they are reading and learning about. And so this is one of the things that's prominent in the American system and unfortunately is not universal with other countries around the earth. And so what we discover is a heavy emphasis on memorize the facts and not much encouragement to get students into applying what they've learned. And so that application, you know, leads to analysis, leads to, you know, clear evaluation. And these are the skills that we tend to do well. One other thing, and I want to give a shout out to Trip Goodall. He really helped me back in August when I was preparing for my departure. And one of the things that we discussed was teacher evaluation process. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I had a clue from my previous visits to Egypt was that we need an effective teacher evaluation tool. And so in Canby, we've used the Charlotte Danielson framework for more years than I can count. You know, it's how I was evaluated as a teacher when I was teaching in the district. Mm-hmm. And so basically, I hand carried all of the Danielson framework, including the forms that we used in Canby. And we just simply restructured those forms. And so now I put on a series of workshops for our entire faculty and then for our administrative team how to best use the Danielson model. And here again, I'm afraid I'm jumping right into teacher speak, and there are people listening to this. What on earth is the Danielson model?
Right.
What the Danielson model emphasizes is teacher reflection. And so, for instance, when an administrator is going to observe a teacher's lesson, it's a three-part activity. So on the day before the observation, you have a pre-observation conference. And in this conference, the teacher will inform the administrator, okay, here are the things that are up and coming in my lesson. And furthermore, here are some things I'd like some feedback on. You know, I'd like you to watch for these details in the lesson. And so then we get to the lesson observation itself, and then the administrator would be recording notes and especially watching for those details that the teacher requested the day before. So then, you know, the administrator will write a summary of the notes, and then the following day would be a post-observation meeting where first the teacher is basically asked, okay, so what went well, you know, and my favorite question is, if you were to reteach the same lesson, what would you do differently? Mm. And it's through that question that it really leads the teacher to reflection. You know, yeah, there were a couple of things. If I had made a little, adjustment, maybe it would have gone a little stronger, you know. But we're always looking to perfect, you know, our effort as a teacher. So then what the teachers here discover is, wow, okay, this is really not just, hey, you did this right, you did this wrong, and you know, a critical comment, but rather demonstrating working together, the administrator and the teacher, and the teacher taking the lead with the self-reflection. And so I have found this to be an effective tool. And like I say, it's one that we've used in Canby for 4 years that I can count. And now we've adapted it for our use here at school in Egypt.
Cool. Yeah, I think that what you're talking about before, as far as the differences between just, you know, acquiring facts and actually learning, or, you know, learning how to think, and teachers teaching students how to think, maybe that's a part of that is just the difficulty of sort of quantifying that in terms of standardized testing and things and sort of measuring that, because it's easy to, you know, just measure facts and sort of compare those apples to apples. Do you know, you know, the capital of Egypt or don't you? But in terms of how do you measure how well a person thinks? Maybe that's kind of some of the difficulties when we compare, you know, school districts and school systems across different states and different countries and, you know, even different continents across the ocean. So,
you know, yes, of course, it is the challenge to make comparisons from one system to another when, you know, the simple, easy way is just to have some quantitative data, you know,
right.
But when it goes beyond just those numbers, then it does become a challenge. But I will tell you this, yes, we do test our students, and coincidentally, my very first week here on site, I was sitting in on a presentation of what last year's test data revealed in terms of how our school compares with other schools in Egypt, and then how we compare with other American accredited schools in other countries around the world outside the U.S. And so then, lo and behold, the test is the MAP test, M-A-P is the acronym. And the headquarters for MAP is, lo and behold, Portland, Oregon.
Oh, no way.
So we're using the testing measure you know, from back home. Mm-hmm. So it's like, wow. And one of my favorite contact people at MAP in Portland is Darlene Hooley, retired member of the United States Congress, but
right.
First and foremost, a teacher, a fellow teacher. And so, I've been trying to reach out to Darlene and say, hey, guess what? We're using your tools right here in Cairo, Egypt.
Wow. Small world.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from one of our sponsors. And when we return, we will bring you the second part of our conversation with Mr. Tony in Egypt.
I'm here at Advantage Mortgage with Derek Hill. And Derek, you were telling me about something that just came down from Fannie Mae that people might be interested in.
Yeah, Fannie Mae just came out with a report that said that the average homeowner in the United States has approximately 70% equity in their home.
Oh, now, wow.
Right. I mean, that's obviously average throughout the whole country. But because values have come up so substantially in the last 10 years, there is a ton of equity available that people can utilize.
Cool. So if people are potentially like looking to buy or move into a new home, you're saying that equity means it might be something that you would look at remodeling instead of if the market's not looking favorable to you.
Right, 100%. Because the market in Portland is so tough to buy, you know, we have an average of like 2.5 months worth of inventory. So it's just super hard for people to find what they're looking for. It may be just easier for them to take out some equity and do the upgrades or do an addition or pay off some debt or lots of different things. And that's one of the things that we love to do with people is sit down with them and kind of go over a game plan. You know,
cool.
Just that's one of the biggest things is knowing what you can do. And we love taking the time to do that for people.
Awesome. Awesome. And people can find you on your website or just give you a call.
They can go to findtheadvantage.com or call 266-5800, obviously 503 area code. And we love to chit-chat. And we have, you know, 8 or 9 different loan officers here in the Canby office that would love to sit down with somebody and work with them.
Cool. Thanks, Derek.
So just remember, Derek Hill, NMLS number 50183, Advantage Mortgage, NMLS number 177059, Equal Housing Opportunity.
Well, we are running out of time here, Tony, but I did have a couple more questions I wanted to ask you. I love hearing like, you know, the similarities, you know, the unexpected similarities that you're finding over there. But what I was most interested in was really more maybe some of the differences. Like, I mean, you're here this long time, you know, small town community teacher in a city of maybe as many as 30 million people living in an apartment building that may be about as big as the town you once lived in. Are there any sort of like, you know, stories that you could tell in that sense, maybe kind of a we're not in Kansas anymore Toto kind of moments that just hit you?
You know, there are a couple of stories that I can share. One is just getting comfortable with the change of diet. Now, I don't want to over-dramatize this because, you know, pretty much anything that you can find at Thriftway, you can find at our local grocery store here. And mm-hmm. so it's not that big a change, but I will say this, when you eat out, for example, a breakfast out, you won't find pancakes and eggs and bacon, you know, on the menu. That's just not what they think of, when they think of breakfast. So when we had breakfast out this morning, we had a dish that's called fool. The English spelling of it is F-O-U-L, but it's pronounced fool. And it's really much like refried beans, you know, Mexican refried beans. And they have these wonderful spices and sauces that you put in with it. It's really pretty good. And then falafel.
They don't just cover it in cheddar cheese. That's how I like it.
I have to tell you, we did have a cheese dish that was very tasty, and I've had that repeatedly here as well. Cheese is popular in food dishes. You know, falafel is a local favorite, but
falafel.
And then having salads, you know, with your breakfast. Green salads. But the thing to die for is the bread, the flat bread. It's kind of like I describe it as like a heavy tortilla.
So not like a naan, like more of a very flat.
Yes, flat. And sometimes it's like a pocket bread, you know, so it'll have a, you know, when you tear it, you know, you got a hollow inside. The tradition is when you sit down to have meals, you tear off the bread and then you use the bread to dip into the other dishes and eat it with the bread. And mm-hmm. so you know, that's just something that's a little different. If I'm looking for something that's maybe borderline humorous, I will tell you that when riding in vehicles in the highways and the streets here, first of all, yes, there are stripes on the road, but as one of my local friends said, they're just for decoration. Nobody pays attention to them. And so the cars just go everywhere. But I will say this, to the credit of the Egyptian drivers, they don't run stop signs and they don't run traffic lights, because stop signs and traffic lights simply do not exist. You go to any intersection and they just kind of weave their way through. Yeah, you just don't find them anywhere, you know. But it's amazing to me how everyone here just self manages, you know, in terms of driving.
Right. Well, they don't have those crutches, so they stay alert and stay off their phones and pay attention to what's going on.
and they are constantly honking. But what I've learned is the honking is not out of aggression. It's honking just to communicate, to be informative. You know, hey, I'm on your left, I'm on your right. You know, or if a car starts fading your way, you know, you give a honk to remind them, hey, I'm here. And they avoid each other, and the wrecks are just very few. You know, so they do self-manage fairly well. But I have to tell you one thing, just a fun thing in terms of comparison. So our kindergarten classes, we have 9 kindergarten classes. And so on Sunday, they are having a day where they are celebrating a comparison between Egypt and the United States. And so they're going to be dressing and clothing and sampling foods and all of these things. So I was asked if I would put together a little slideshow of photos showing, you know, like my family experiences, you know, from where I live in the U.S. And so I did put together a slideshow, and you know, here we are having a picnic, you know, at the Malala River State Park, and here we are cheering for our team at a Blazer game, you know, and stuff like this, you know, just family kinds of things that we do. And they're amazed at, you know, all of these things. It's the same things that, you know, families do with their kids here. But I had to laugh at one of the photos that a teacher used to compare clothing between Egyptians and Americans. And so they showed a photo of a man and a woman in traditional Egyptian attire, and they're both dressed in all white, and the woman is in an abaya, and the man is in the counterpart, you know, to an abaya, and so then they went to the typical American attire, and here's a man and a woman, and they're both dressed like cowboys. Cowboy hat, blue jeans, cowboy boots, you know, Western
just traditional
style.
Formal attire, man. That's all that was. Yeah.
You know, and I have to admit, the first time I saw that photo, and that's supposed to be typical American, you know, clothing, I just busted up laughing. And it was
I
just,
love that, you know, so much.
I laughed right out loud. Great. And so then I was asked, so Mr. Tony, do you have a cowboy hat? And I said, well, in fact, I do.
I live in Canby.
You know, and I said, I wear it every year for our county fair and
for the rodeo.
The rodeo, and, you know.
Of course.
But and then I did tease some of the female teachers, and I said, yes, and my wife likes my cowboy hat very much. And so so they were just kind of chuckling, like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But
anyway,
yes, I had a cowboy hat, so I validated their image of what
their stereotype. Well, I love the driving stories. I feel like here in Canby, sometimes the maybe some of our friends that I see at the Fred Meyer parking lot sometimes think those lines are just for decoration. But Tony, we're almost out of time here. I did want to just give you a minute. Is there anything you'd like to say to the folks back here at home?
You know, I'll tell you what, I miss just not being at home, but in fact, I was asked this question, Mr. Tony, do you miss your family and friends from back home? And I said, yes, of course I do. But I also countered that by saying, but during the time I have been here, I have never had a moment where I have felt lonely. I have been embraced, you know, with new friends, and they all tell me, just they say, you're part of our family. You know, we've adopted you into our family. And so I have to say to anyone who's listening to this podcast, If you have interest in wanting to join me, I have accommodations in my apartment. I've got an extra bedroom and an extra bathroom. And anybody who wants to come visit, contact me, contact my wife, contact you, Tyler. If someone wants to come pay a visit to Egypt, what they will experience is among the finest hospitality and generosity that you will witness and experience anywhere on earth. The people here are just pretty wonderful to be with.
Awesome. And Tony, you are coming back here in about 6 months in August?
Yes, I will be back July 1st. My flight home is June 30th. That's when my school year and contract year ends. And so I look forward to being home just in time for the 4th of July. And
That'll be great. Yes. We'll have you leading the parade.
Hey, I'll be happy just to be home and eat a hot dog and and watch the fireworks. It'll be a lot of fun. Yes.
I'm going to have them put some refried beans on that hot dog just for you, Tony, okay?
Hey, there we go. I'll think I'm in two places at once.
There you go. Thanks so much, Tony, for talking to us.
Hey, Tyler, this has been a pleasure. And I do want you to know I am listening to Can Be Now podcast over here on a regular basis.
Oh, really?
It's my way of keeping in contact with the community, and I appreciate all the great work that you're doing with the podcast. And just know that you're reaching out worldwide. And
thank you.
very much enjoyed here.
Well, we appreciate that. That really means a lot. I've been wondering why we're getting all that weird traffic from Cairo, Egypt. Now I know, so.
Can Be Then is brought to you by Retro Revival. They are not your average antique shop. They're open daily. And though the store is currently closed for walk-in sales, they offer a variety of online shopping experiences along with free delivery in Canby. You can connect with them through email at retrorevivaloc@gmail.com. Much of the history of a town can be gleaned from the history of its fires. In these stories, we see a community's courage, values, and in Canby's case anyway, a little bit of its charm. Two terrible fires occurred in the vicinity of Canby in 1916. The first happened at Wilhoit Springs in Molalla, named after its discoverer, pioneer John Wilhoit. 45 years earlier, John Wilhoit had laid claim to the property and constructed the building that would become the Wilhoit Springs Hotel. Wilhoit Springs is now a county park, but in 1916 it was one of Clackamas County's most well-known and popular tourist destinations. The hotel contained 40 rooms, and there were numerous cottages surrounding it as well. Fortunately, when the fire broke out in February, the hotel was closed and only one patron was lodging there. The McLaren brothers, who operated the hotel, tried to put out the blaze with chemical fire extinguishers, but their efforts were useless. The hotel burned to the ground, as did two of the cottages. There's a happy ending to the story, at least. Less than 6 months later, a new, larger, and improved Wilhoit Springs Hotel was opened on the site of the old one. Built from big logs harvested on the property, the hotel hosted a large crowd from Canby, Oregon City, Salem, and Portland for its grand opening on July 22nd. A turkey dinner was served, and the party danced until after midnight, the Oregonian reported. A second terrible 1916 fire happened in April in Hubbard, breaking out in an office building and decimating much of the downtown core. Newspapers reported that the fire spread rapidly and threatened to destroy most of the town. Firefighting apparatus and even dynamite were called for from neighboring Woodburn. In 1923, a fire of unknown origin decimated the Barlow Post Office, which was also the home of W.S. Bud Toll. Fortunately, Bud wasn't home. The fire started in the home's attached woodshed and quickly spread, even burning down several telephone poles that knocked out service for the area temporarily. And then in May 1942, a two-year-old St. Bernard named Prince heroically saved thousands of Thanksgiving dinners from being barbecued 6 months early. Prince, the farm dog at a Maxburg turkey factory owned by a Mr. and Mrs. Lamore, was sleeping in his usual perch on the second floor of a hatchery building when he sensed something amiss. His loud barking attracted the nightman, who soon found that an overheated stove in the brooder house had set the building on fire. More than 5,000 young turkeys were inside. The alarm was sounded, and the local firefighters arrived promptly on the scene. They extinguished the blaze before considerable damage was done, resulting in only a small hole in the roof and the loss of about a dozen birds. A contingent of Canby firefighters asked to be on hand to protect the fairgrounds during the annual fireworks show were late to arrive to the Clackamas County Fair in 1949, but it wasn't their fault. Just blame the overzealous ticket takers at the gate booth who refused to let them in until they had paid admission. They paid, rather than have an argument, said a gracious fire chief Clayton Yoder, who was among the party. Two of them had previously purchased season passes. The rest were charged daily admission. 60 cents. It was a good thing, too. No less than two fires broke out in the dry grass that night, which Canby firefighters were able to put out with hand hoses. The Everybody Pays Police, as dubbed by the Canby Herald, also caught the youngsters who marched in the Kitty Capers Parade on opening day. The kiddies had been thrilled with the chance to be part of the parade and march with the giant Cliff Thompson, a Hollywood actor who was a reputed 8 feet 7 inches tall, and they thought they'd be able to sit in the grandstand and enjoy the rest of the show. But they, too, were hunted down and charged admission. As a lover and a longtime attendee of the Clackamas County Fair, this story really doesn't surprise me at all. The 70s was a time of radical growth and change for the country, and it was also true in Canby. It was also time for a bunch of huge fires. One that stands out, and that some listeners may even remember, was the devastating fire at the Canby Big Store, a local landmark for over 60 years, which was engulfed and completely destroyed in less than an hour in August of 1973. 35 of the district's 38 firefighters fought to control the blaze within the 10,000-square-foot concrete building, which had been erected in 1913. The three-story building, which at one time was the largest retail store in Clackamas County, had been a marketplace that housed a number of businesses: the Canby Land Market, Top Flight Beauty Shop, Canby Hardware and Implement Company, Gene Look's Television Repair Shop. Most of them were decimated in the fire, which started at the back wall and spread quickly along the wood floors, ceilings, and staircases. Also destroyed was a Volkswagen owned by Miss Margaret Schoonover. It caught fire when the store's first floor windows exploded and shot flames across the street. The losses, in terms of the building, merchandise, and equipment, was estimated at over $300,000, the equivalent of more than $1.6 million today. Another 1973 fire happened in Woodburn, but it was covered in the Canby Herald and bears mentioning here. The fire broke out at an unassuming building on Front Street that was leased to a company called TLM Publishing Company. The building itself was owned by Eugene Stoller, former publisher of the Woodburn Independent. No one was hurt in the fire, but it caused an estimated $15,000 to $20,000 in damages. So, well, why was it noteworthy? Well, first of all, it was pretty clear it was an act of arson. Woodburn firefighters said the door into the publishing company had been forced open, and the fire showed evidence of two separate points of origin, as well as an explosion. Also, TLM Publishing Company published a very specific type of newspaper, pornographic newspapers. Their titles were Ginger and Spice and the Whorehouse Gazette. According to Fire Chief Martin Krupika, it was really hardcore stuff. I'd sure say it sounds like it was pretty hot. Hey-ho! Tyler, these jokes, buddy. Let's work on them. Anyway, we have many more colorful and thrilling stories to share with you from the history of Canby Fire District, but you'll have to wait till next time on Canby Then.
Tyler, did you know that the Australian lyrebird can mimic any sound that it hears, even chainsaws?
No, that's super interesting.
Did you know that a baby puffin is called a puffling? Or no. That baby sea otters can't swim, so their moms wrap them up in pieces of kelp until they learn how to paddle.
Wait, do you know any trivia that isn't like animal related?
Not really, but here's some stuff you may not know about the Wild Hare Saloon, where Camby goes to eat and have fun.
Okay.
The Wild Hare is one of Camby's longest running locally owned restaurants. Owners Joan and Darren Moden have been in business for 16 years.
That's cool.
Yeah, heck, you were just a baby back then. And they love to give back. They've been members of the Camby Chamber for that long, and they donate over $20,000 to local sports, FFA programs, and civic organizations each year.
Wow, I'm legitimately like caught off. That's cool.
Yeah. They also support more than 30 jobs in the community through their award-winning staff, some of them as young as 18. Hey, that's older than you are.
Dude, I'm 10 months younger than you.
With the days getting longer and the weather getting warmer, the Camby Wild Hare's expansive outdoor patio is the place to be. Furry friends, welcome.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to go check them out just off of Highway 99E next to the Space Age in Camby at 1656 Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City or on their website at thewildhairsaloon.net. The Camby Now podcast is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Camby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. Find more of her work at olivia13.com.
The Camby Now podcast is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The Camby Now podcast is a production of Now Hear This Studios, Camby's locally owned full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.